Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is America. Don't got you slipping up. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping up. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry him.
Childish Gambino doing This is America. And so, with that as backdrop, for a final thought in our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade, here in 2018, with Trump as president and as the perceived champion of the white working class based on their votes, a long-term culture war artifact continues. Conservative, working-class whites resent the elites in part because the elites are seen as disfavoring them while favoring working-class people of color. Can it be different? Can racial polarization among working-class Americans become a more unified, class-based political movement in the age of middle-class decline and massive income inequality? With me now is Tamara Drought, Vice President of Policy and Research for the liberal think tank Demos, and author of the book Sleeping Giant, The Untapped Economic and Political Power of America's New Working Class. She predicts that a new working class could soon become a unified political force. Tamara, welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be with you, Brian.
Who is the new working class?
So the new working class, you know, I come from a working class family. I think our political dialogue and our cultural views of the working class is pretty outdated at this point. I think people still think of folks like my dad. He went off, worked in a steel factory, hard hat, steel toe boots. The working class has changed dramatically. The working class basically went from making stuff to serving and caring for people. And the people doing those jobs also changed. The working class today is much more female. It's much more black and brown than it was in my dad's generation. So that's the context of who is this new working class and how can we actually unify them as opposed to making them divide from one another.
I wonder if you think this makes it harder, because you argue that low-income occupations have been robbed of their dignity to a troubling degree. But one of the surprising findings in our WNYC Harris poll was that when we asked if the top 1% were doing more harm than good in our country today, we asked it as the top 1% in wealth, only 43% said more harm. I might have thought it would be much more than that in this period, 10 years after the financial crisis of 2008. Any first impressions about what that represents?
Well, you know, polls are both art and science, and I might want to quibble with the art of the way the question was framed. But leaving that aside, you know, I think Americans want to be wealthy, right? So there is this line that we have to be careful not to cross where we're demonizing wealth. What we actually need to be pointing out is the behavior of the 1% that's problematic, the greed, the using divide and conquer, particularly along race lines, to divide struggling people of all races from one another. That's what we have to start pointing out, is how the 1% is rigging the system and often using dog whistle politics and strategic racism to form a cleavage between the working class.
So you believe that race and racism has been the Achilles heel, I think you used that term, of an organized working class?
I think it has. I mean, it's almost since time eternal here in this country, there has been a real deliberate attempt to splinter struggling people across racial lines. You had it in Bacon's Rebellion. You have it in the formation of the Southern Strategy by the Republican Party in the late 60s. It's a very popular tool. We saw it with the Trump administration, right? Demonizing, this time it morphed from, you know, Ronald Reagan's welfare queens to the bad hombres of immigrants, and him talking about immigrants in terms of rapists and all of that. So it is a proven and sadly very effective strategy to say, don't look at us running away and stacking the deck in our favor. Point the finger at those other people, be them poor people, black people, or immigrants.
So listeners, what do you think? Is it a solution to part of the culture wars that the white working class and people of color working class can come together in the future, resolving much of the culture wars, because they are often fought out among the working classes while the elites take whatever sides they take but aren't as affected? And what do you think it would take to bring that about? 212-433 WNYC 433-9692, or any questions for Tamara Drought from Demos, an author now of Sleeping Giant, The Untapped Economic and Political Power of America's New Working Class, 212-433-9692. So how do you bridge that racial divide?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways. One, to connect back to the last conversation, which was fascinating. So Demos just finished a year-long study about how to talk about race and class with people of all races, but particularly of working class people of all races. And one of the things we have to keep remembering is that people are very worried about the level of division. They want to be unified. And so what we found a way to bring that unification, to highlight the common ground, is to do a couple things. One, start by setting some real unity, you know, that working people of all races want to be able to get a job and care for themselves and their families. Talk about how divide and conquer is really aimed at scapegoating and pointing the finger for our struggles at a smaller group of people, be it immigrants or Black people. Remind people in our past that we did come together and do good things, like the civil rights movement, like labor rights. And then finally, end with a call to action that we have to come together and elect officials who are going to serve all of us, not just the wealthy few.
Here's one final history clip from earlier in the series that we're going to reprise because it's relevant to this. And it indicates how unions and maybe African Americans have kind of changed sides, or at least changed, on immigration, our big culture war issue at the moment, and one that's so relevant if you're going to create a racially unified working class in this country as we become increasingly Latino and increasingly Asian, that has to be part of it, not just Black and white. And this is Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, well-known progressive and civil rights advocate, in 1995 after leading an immigration reform commission for President Clinton.
What the commission is concerned about are the unskilled workers in our society. In an age in which unskilled workers have far too few opportunities open to them, when immigrants are less well-educated and less skilled, they may pose economic hardships for the most vulnerable of Americans, particularly those who are unemployed or underemployed.
So Barbara Jordan in 1995, and as I think you know, Tamara, the anti-immigration forces play that clip or another one from the same speech, even in television commercials today, to argue against immigration. But at that time, there was a civil rights leader and progressive Democratic member of Congress from Texas saying there really was, in the working classes, a competition for opportunities and opportunity, and we have to watch the numbers. How do you bring that forward to today? Why did progressive America flip? Why did the unions flip? Because the unions used to have that protection position.
Not all the unions. The AFL, I think, was the last to flip. It took a very long time, and they now have a pro-immigration and pro-immigration reform stance. I would look at the SEIU, who long ago has been one, it's the fastest growing union. It represents primarily immigrant women.
That's the service
and
employees.
Yes, thank
union.
You. Thank you.
Relating to
healthcare
what you
workers.
Said before, how we're moving from a manufacturing right. economy to a service economy.
And then I think the other thing that's changed is we actually now have more evidence that actually it's not a zero-sum game, that immigrants coming in are actually not competing and taking jobs away from Native Americans, people who I think Barbara Jordan was particularly probably concerned about is immigrants coming over, taking jobs away from Black Americans. We know that's not the case. So we have to move beyond this zero-sum idea. We know it's not a zero-sum game, that in fact, we can all get ahead if we actually prioritize things that help all of us get ahead, right?
Let's take a phone call. And it's Don in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you, Brian?
Good, thank you.
Okay. Now, I'd like to bring up Reverend Barber's Poor People's Campaign and also his book on the Third Reconstruction, mm-hmm. talking about how he went to a community just outside Asheville, North Carolina, which was 99% white and 100% Republican. But they called Reverend Barbara because of his Moral Monday demonstrations in Raleigh, North Carolina, just to see if he was really talking about helping everybody, not just black people, but also people who are not doing very well in places like just outside Asheville, North Carolina.
Don, thank you very much. In fact, we were trying to get Reverend Barber to come on Tuesday's show. We happened to know that he was in New York this week, but he wasn't able to do it. But maybe he's a model. When white America sees Reverend Barber on television, they may see him as a, quote, black leader, as Don is framing it, and as Reverend Barber would like to be seen, he's a poor people's leader.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's a tradition that harkens back to Martin Luther King Jr., right? So it's a revival of idea. And I think, you know, one thing we often forget is that the civil rights movement was also about economic justice. And clearly the leaders at the time realized that economic justice had to be for all people, including struggling white poor people. So I think Reverend Barber is a great example, and it reminds us that we actually do have more in common than we have in disagreement, but we have to continue to work towards that. And that is especially difficult, you know, as your last conversation was highlighting, in a climate where we have a president who is daily trying to divide us from one another and using very toxic, divisive, racial scapegoating language.
Michael in Freehold, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hello. I had a comment. Your guest, when she first came on, was talking about how, you know, historically it was the Republicans who was using this, you know, unfortunately effective method of using, you know, racial divides to try to advance their agenda. But, you know, one thing that struck me is that I feel like, and, you know, I'm a registered Democrat, recently the Democratic Party has been doing the exact same thing. You know, we especially saw this play out during the primary election this last cycle when Bernie Sanders came in with an economic message. And I still remember that commercial he ran with all of the different faces, all different races and creeds, and with that economic justice message, and we're all in the same boat. And instead, Hillary Clinton took the approach of identity politics, and we saw it play out in the polls that Bernie Sanders was having trouble polling with minorities. And I just feel like the Democratic Party has doubled down on, you know, what are some divisive stances for many Americans. And I just see them just getting more and more hard line on these things. So I was wondering if, you know, the guest could comment on how this played out in the primary election and how the Democratic Party has actually, you know, gone forward since the 2016 primaries.
Great question. Thank you for bringing that up. So a couple things. I think the Democratic Party needs to do two things. It needs to continue to be the party of inclusion and civil rights, and it needs to get back to its working class roots. Those things are very compatible in my mind. You know, I don't want to go back to Clinton and Sanders. We've all relived that. But I will say this. When people are under attack, they want to know that somebody has their back and is standing up for them. So when you're fearful for your life or of deportation, it is not enough for a Democrat to say, I'm going to give you a raise. They have to give you a raise and talk about those dangers.
And then how do you bring in the white working class Republicans who have other issues? They don't like affirmative action. They don't like legal abortion in many cases. Sometimes, you know, we saw in our poll that in the South, religious feeling was seen as very important, not as much in other parts of the country. But then, so you have the social justice concerns on the one hand, you have social issue concerns from the right on the other hand, which pull, you know, in two different directions against an economically unified working class.
Only if you think that the entire white working class believes socially conservative ideas. And what I would say is that to build a progressive majority, we have to be okay. We, meaning progressives and the Democratic Party, they have to be okay that we're not going to win everybody in the white working class. I would say probably 20% of people are not winnable back to the Democratic coalition. That said, there is a lot of white working class people that both want an economic populist message and want unity and believe in fairness and racial inclusiveness. Those are the folks and the messages we need to run on so that we energize our base and bring along the white people who are with us on core principles of fairness and justice.
For you, as an example of that, the Fight for 15 or $15 minimum wage campaign was a transformative model, right?
It is a transformative model. It's cross-racial. It's largely led, though, by women of color, particularly black women. And through its activism, it has managed to give workers $62 billion in wage increases through ballot initiatives and state legislatures raising their minimum wage, all because this band of workers right here in New York City, fast food workers, decided to walk off their job in 2013. And look at what we've accomplished in 5 years.
What's the next one? And we have 15 seconds left.
The next big movement? Well, I'm not sure it's a movement. I'm very energized by the movements we see. The Women's March movement, Black Lives Matter, Dreamers, and Fight for 15.
Those are identity movements, right? Not economic movements.
Fight for 15?
Other than Fight for 15.
But what I would say is that for a lot of people in this country, social and economic justice, racial and economic justice are one and the same thing.
Tamara Drought, Vice President at Demos, the liberal think tank and author of Sleeping Giant, The Untapped Economic and Political Power of America's New Working Class. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And so ends our series, The Eights, a brief history of the culture wars decade by decade. Special thanks to Brian Lehrer producer Amina Cerna, who did such an incredible job as she did nothing but work on the series for the last 2 months. Her historical news and music research was especially central to what you all have been hearing. As a punishment, or probably relief, Amina rejoins the usual rotation of duties for the show. The Eights has been 28 segments of this program over 28 days. It's available for binge listening if you want to go chronologically or any other way. And please tell your friends. They can hear it anytime at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening in America to The Eights.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up.